Are we on? All right. So, having become Vajrasattva, what does one want to do? Well, I think we concluded that there's clearly a shift in motivation that occurs as one goes to from identifying with being an ego to being Vajrasattva. And the shift in motivation is essentially from what's called a deficiency-based motive, that is, a separate self-sense is inherently founded on and expressive of a sense of lack or deficiency. That seems to be just be part and parcel of being an ego. The existentialists would call it angst. The Buddhists would call it an element of, or an inescapable element of dukkha. And the shift to Vajrasattva is the shift from deficiency-based motivation to sufficiency-based motivation. That is, inherent in this identity is a sense of fullness, wholeness, identification with true nature, which is wholly lacking in any sense of lack or deficiency. And motivated by the desire to give or to share. So that takes two expressions then. For those who are lacking, there's a desire to fill that lack. For those who are not lacking, for those who have already awakened, there's a desire simply to bless. So we then move to the stage of quite naturally, as an expression of the previous realization, radiating gifts to the Buddhas. Radiating gifts to the Buddhas, is this part of...
It happens in the next part, not specifically in the Vajrasattva.
Oh, it doesn't?
Yeah.
Oh, you have.
But again, this is an element that comes in all the practice.
Yeah. Okay. All right, well, let's see.
And it happens for us in the practice because you're imagining all beings being purified and transformed into it at the same time.
Okay, so in your version, you are doing the emptying of cyclic existence.
Yeah, because it's done by everyone having Vajrasattva above their head, this whole process happening, liberating everybody together.
And do you go around the different realms and liberate beings in each realm?
No, not in that part, no.
Okay.
Yeah. In Chenrezig, that happens, and other various places, so.
Okay. Well, let me adapt accordingly then.
Talk about these, because they are all principles that turn up. Whether or not they specifically turn up in exactly the same way, they definitely turn up in the in the practices that...
Okay. This is in the version that I did, one next moves spontaneously to a practice of radiating blessings to all bodhisattvas and Buddhas. And we can slot that in as a natural part of the next practice you'll be doing, which is the mandala offering, in which you do exactly that. And there's some very valuable principles to be aware of here. What you're doing in the mandala offering is offering the greatest gifts you can possibly imagine, offering whole world realms, zillions and zillions of world realms, to the greatest beings. So you're offering the most exquisite gifts you can conceive of, and as many as you can conceive of, to the highest beings and all those beings. And this is an exquisite visualization of boundless giving. So, and boundless giving is, this visualization is extraordinarily powerful for several reasons. It's the essence of the mandala offering and of the four immeasurables. And it's powerful because it is a boundless offering. That is, you're offering as much as you can possibly conceive of without any exception or reservation. And if you recall the principle that within the mind what you intend for another, you tend to experience yourself, then you can get that boundless giving, giving all the positivity you could conceive of, would be a way of generating an awful lot of positivity in one's own mind. And a point of fact, that's where these practices end up. They end up in ecstatic states. simply from that intention of trying to give the most, give and thereby generate the most positive experiences you can conceive of. Where does that get generated? Well, in your own mind. So the four immeasurables and the mandala offering end up can end up in quite ecstatic states out of this wonderful principle of the recognition that the mind operates in a very different way from the physical universe. Within the physical universe, you give something, you lose it. Within the mind, you give something, you gain it. Okay? And there's a nice saying in a Christian mystical text, to have, give all to all. So to give boundless positive feelings is to experience boundless positive feelings, which is ecstasy. The emptying cyclic existence is, you're saying, is part of another practice?
It comes up in different ways.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, let me talk a little bit about...
talk about that. I mean, I think it would be useful.
Okay.
They'll encounter it, you know, in other ways, and it manifests in this practice, as I said, by everybody being
Bodhisattva, Okay. Well, in the version I did, there's a beautiful twist to this. First, you radiate blessings to the Buddha as to the Buddhas as and Bodhisattvas as Vajrasattva, and then you receive their blessings back and are also transformed into a Buddha. And again, I found it very useful to look very closely at what is this archetypal figure Buddha represent or symbolize. And clearly it's one who has stabilized recognition of their true nature and brought to fruition all beneficial qualities and capacities as distinct to the Bodhisattvas who symbolize the bringing to fruition of a specific quality, whether it be the compassion of Tara or the loving kindness of the four immeasurables of and love of Chenrezig or purity of Vajrasattva. And as a Buddha, well, what would motivate you? Well, of course, even more so, the desire to share one's blessings, one's benefits. And the expression of that in the practice that I work with, and it sounds like there's a variation of this in the way you're working with it, is that in the practice I work with, you go through and do what's called emptying of cyclic existence. That is, you run around the six realms and visualize the liberation of beings in each realm. And that, of course, that comes up in a number of different practices, but... since it was key to the Vajrasattva practice I was doing, and since you'll keep running across it, let me go into it a little bit, as Paulden said. So what you're doing is basically attempting to relieve the suffering of all six realms and to transform beings into Vajrasattvas. And there seem to be many possible ways of doing this visualization. I found very valuable to experiment with different variations. Since variation produces a number of different insights and also keeps the mind interested and alert with all the different novel approaches. So the idea is you've got the six realms of existence and you either can do it in two ways. You can visualize the liberation of all beings simultaneously in all the six realms, or you can go through the six realms successively. Well, with liberating them all simultaneously, you can visualize it either as a process or as an instantaneous happening. Doing it successively, I found it very interesting to focus on each realm and then kind of do some exploration to go to take a realm in turn and then look at very carefully, investigate, okay, so what is the actual kind of suffering that the being in this each realm is going through, and what's its cause, and what's the appropriate antidote? Well, it turns out that there are many levels to that investigation. Yes, there's a supposedly specific kind of suffering in each realm. In the hungry ghost realm or the predator realm, it's the realm of insufficiency, insufficient particularly food. In the animal realm, it's dullness, cognitive dullness. In the jealous god realms, or it's a jealousy of those who have more. But you can identify the specific kind of suffering, and then you can look at, well, what's causing it, and you can understand. What I found is you can understand that at many levels, and then you can see there are different kinds of antidotes appropriate to each level. So, for example, if you look at, say, the jealous god realm, if you want to take a contemporary example, we have wonderful ones just down the freeway in Santa Clara, where you'll have all these newly minted millionaires who are feeling incredibly inadequate because they're not billionaires. Yeah. And it's literal. I'm not kidding you. When you do psychotherapy and get to work with some of these people, it's very interesting, you know. Well, you know, oh, okay, so you retired at 31. Well, that's very nice. Yeah, but I mean, I only just made it. This is literal. I only made $4 million, so I just, you know, I'm really at the bottom. Okay, poor you. So what are the causes of their suffering, these people in the kind of psychological jealous god realm, and what are the appropriate remedies one can offer in a visualization? Now, you know, I found it interesting to work with a literal classic visualization of the jealous gods in their god realm and also these millionaires, for example, and just play with those variations. Well, what's the cause? Well, in this example, we're using, well, most obvious cause is the poor millionaires don't have enough money. So you could visualize yourself giving them more money. But that probably isn't going to really heal it. Underneath that is a mind state of agitation and dissatisfaction. So one could work with and play with and do the visualization of offering them calm and peace. And you would, of course, experience calm and peace yourself. But below that is the comparing mind. You know, that's where that suffering is coming from. They're comparing themselves with others, and that one in the Theravadin psychology is with us all the way until our hardship. So it's a pretty deep one. So one could offer them equanimity, which is the freedom from comparing, and one would experience that oneself. Or below that is, or associated with that anyway, is one could see an inadequate and poor self-image. So one could offer them a sense of adequacy and self-esteem. And associated with that, deep to that, is jealousy. It's the defining mental defilement of the jealous god realm. So what's the antidote to jealousy? Well, it's mudita. Empathic joy, happiness at the happiness of others. So you could offer them that. Instead of feeling jealous of the god realm, they could feel delighted that the gods are enjoying that. Below that's a sense of fundamental sense of deficiency or lack. So you could play with offering them sufficiency. What would it be like for them to feel sufficient and adequate? Well, below the sense of sufficiency is tanha, fundamental craving or thirst. You know, Buddhist teachings is associated with a separate self sense is a sense of deficiency, which leads to a sense of craving. And so one could relieve that craving. But what's the sense of craving come from? Well, it comes clearly from a mistaken self-identity, from a failure to recognize the four marks of existence, and from a failure to appreciate shunyata. Someone could offer them the gift of insight into shunyata. Or alternatively, one could offer them the recognition of Rigpa, Mahamudra, which would be the final antidote. So one can, in my experience, as you kind of explore each of these realms, you can see the surface suffering actually reflects far deeper layers of psychological and spiritual processes. And one can play with, that kind of investigation builds an understanding of those, the nature and causes of suffering in those beings and, of course, in oneself. And then one sees how one can work with that in various ways at different levels. And in doing so, you use the visualization to experiment, to investigate, to cultivate insight, and also to maintain interest. For myself, my mind's pretty restless. I like to, you know, be playing with and trying different things. So this is one way of maintaining interest and investigation. And then you can run around the six realms for doing that with each realm and gain insight into the causes of each kind of suffering, okay, and various ways of working with that. Comments?
Roger, I missed what you said, attentive for comparative mind. What do you think?
Sympathetic joy.
I was thinking equanimity underneath.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking the whole realm, the whole realm of jealous gods, yeah. Equanimity, yeah. The realization of equality.
Yeah. So, anything else? Mudita, as empathic joy.
Yeah.
Well, it's usually translated as sympathetic joy. I just find empathic joy a better for me, it works better.
I just came across a couple days ago a translation. We're using a Meta Institute of appreciative joy. So, could be any of those. Mudita.
Yeah, that's the Pali.
Pali, yeah.
Okay, so...
Just the point of what you were saying, that as we're offering that, it's coming to us, so the part of us that lives in the six realms is receiving that healing energy as we're doing that, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and just the other thing... Roger's giving an extensive explanation of what's usually called the two offerings, and a lot of texts they'll say just do the two offerings. So it's to sentient beings and to awakened beings, and there's myriads of ways to do that. So often they'll say radiate light out, perform the two offerings, and that's like all this is happening, you know, like. We're offering to the Buddhas and, you know, all of that, and we're offering to all the sentient beings. A quick way of doing is the light does the whole thing. You know, so the light, and we could work with that in the sense of this light is the nature of equanimity or peace. This light is the nature of realizing shunyata, this light, you know, for the sentient beings or whatever. But anyway, you'll see that in a number of texts that it'll say to do that. Almost every text has that.
You know, in some of these practices, it seems to go on and on. There becomes an automaticness to it. And at those times where less than identified with the more noble qualities of awakened mind and realization, do we still get the benefit of the return that we're giving to Buddhism by the two offerings? Or are we still getting the benefit back, even though we're sort of in a less conscious state?
Well, I assume we're always in a less conscious state, so since the practice seems to work, I assume so, but I also assume that to the extent we bring any of the positive mental qualities to bear on the practice, to that extent the impact and benefits are accentuated. You know, clearly when we're more concentrated and more calm and more still, etc., the practices have an added depth and power. And apropos the conversation we were having at the tea break, one of the things that came up was, and I would put in a plug for me, in these practices, as with all practices, they took on added power and depth and momentum in retreat. So if you at all get the chance to do these in retreat, I'd certainly put in a plug for them. They just really took off for me to another level when I had a month or so just to devote to them. And then, you know, then you have the time to do all these variations and permutations and play with it in any number of different ways. And, you know, if you only have so many minutes in the day, then, you know, radiating light is wonderful. Or it's still wonderful in retreat, but every now, you know, for me it's nice to try variations and to see what I can learn from doing things in different ways. Yeah. Please.
So just on the other end of that spectrum of like feeling like nothing's happening, or you're just, is the spectrum for me where like you I radiate light and it's totally overwhelming. It's like breaking me open to do that, and it's like to think doing that on the tree. Like, I mean, I don't know how to articulate this very well. Mm. It's that place where I just want to be wiped out by the light, the power to move. So there's a kind of a titrating.
And there are certainly times when, particularly in retreat, where practices do feel overwhelming, and then we all can step back and titrate in various ways, or do different practices, or work with it, and it's interesting to see that we are defended against the ecstatic as much as against pain. That was one of the things that really blew me away, seeing that I like to operate in a very nice band, not too unhappy, but not too happy. And that was a real surprise, real surprise. And, of course, the one of the things that happens with practice is the more you practice, the wider range you're able to tolerate. And fortunately, qualities like equanimity also develop, so the same intense experiences happen without knocking us quite so off balance. One learns to bear ecstasy. So, emptying cyclic existence, or blessing all beings, or the two offerings. Then there's a practice which is part of the variation I was using, and is certainly is a part of many different practices, and that is transforming existence into a Buddha field. Is this part of variation? Okay, good. So, in the variation I'm doing, you Vajrasattva, you get blessed by the Buddhas, you become a Buddha. Well, what would you want to do? Well, what would be more... What could you want to do more than create a Buddha field? What could you want to do more than create a universe which was the optimal environment for the drawing out or cultivating of joy, ecstasy, and the awakening of all beings? Has anyone got a better game? That's... best I've heard of, and apparently the best minds in history have come up with, so that's good enough for me. So that the next step is you visualize existence as a Buddha field. But this raises some very interesting questions, which I wrestled with for a while. One is, are you visualizing the world as a Buddha field, or are you recognizing as a Buddha field? Yes. Thank you. It's good to see the non-dual mind at work. Well, I'm a little embarrassed to acknowledge this, but I didn't recognize till this morning that I was totally locked into an essentialist position, even being stuck with that question. And that is, of course, that what Shunyata reveals is that, nothing has a fixed or essential nature, so how could the world as a whole have one? So how could it be, how can one, from that perspective, even be considering the question of, is, you know, are we recognizing or unveiling a Buddha field? That the world, the universe simply is, and it doesn't have an essence, and not having an essence is part of having a Buddha field, or being a Buddha field. So in some ways, that question now, as of today, doesn't make much sense to me. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think just how the mind, you know, it's how the mind works in practice. You know, we hear these things and we think, well, how are we supposed to do that? You know, and we don't necessarily think it through all the way. You know, we're just, the mind is, oh, like, well, how should I do that? You know, is that guy sitting up there, you know? I mean, I remember one of my girlfriends who did 2-3 retreats, she told me, she asked Kalaram, she said, well, what happens when Amitabha goes somewhere? Doesn't he ever go anywhere? Is he always sitting on his throne up in Devadana?
Does he take bathroom breaks?
That's right. And Rinpoche was just like, uh-huh, okay, it doesn't quite work like that. It doesn't really work that way, Dayton, you know. So... In other words, the concretization.
So, if the given that no reality, the universe has no essential nature, what's the optimal way to perceive it? Well, clearly as a Buddha field, which just so happens to be the way the tradition teaches us to perceive things. Interesting coincidence that. Well, that raises the question, what are the practical implications of seeing existence as a Buddha field? Well, the defining feature of a Buddha field is that it's an optimal environment for awakening. Therefore, each experience, person, and interaction is might best be viewed as an opportunity for awakening. And our challenge is how to hold that perspective. And that, of course, is the post-meditation task or challenge we're given with this and the other practices, to continue to hold the implications and appreciation and perspective that the practice has been cultivated in mind, to see this as literally a pure land or Buddha field, and to appreciate each interaction and experience as a opportunity for awakening. And it's an interesting shift in perspective and perception. There's a spectrum of perception which runs from paranoia on one extreme to this at the other, which we could call metanoia. Paranoia is you assume everyone's out to get you. Pronoia is neutrality, is when you assume the world is, you know, what it is, and meaningless, neither benign or malevolent, but probably indifferent. Pronoia is when you assume people are out to help you. A metanoia is when you assume they're out to wake you up. And very interesting perspective. So the challenge is, how much can we hold the perspective of metanoia, which is clearly what these practices are holding out to us as the implication and challenge. Comments?
Well, just so, you know, people make the connection when we're talking about that the universe is guru, all phenomena is guru, that's what they're talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that your own word pointed, metanoia, or is that...
It's a Rogerism. Yeah. I mean, it's a profound vision to see the world as the Lama. This is extraordinary. This is extraordinary vision. And we've all tasted it in various ways. But the challenge, as with so many things, the challenge is stabilization. In one way, you can divide the spiritual path into two phases. One is where you're practicing to get a glimpse And then the practice beyond that is the practice of stabilization, which, you know, may be a life, at least one lifetime's practice. And then finally, the stage of dissolution and completion stage. Here you've spent however long, maybe even a couple of hours or so, on what feels like nothing short of a major trip. And then you systematically dissolve it all into formlessness and recognize and have forced into awareness that all this is just a mind creation. It's all just an expression, manifestation of mind. And then rest in formlessness. And then within that formlessness, anything that arises in the sitting, the challenge now is to see that as the manifestation of the mind of Vajrasattva and as a Buddha field itself. That is, all that arises in the mind is the mind of Vajrasattva expressing itself and is a momentary Buddha field being manifested. So how do we relate to that? Again, how do we optimally relate to what to these creations? And that, as far as I can see, is our life challenge. And that is the end of that practice, or the beginning anyway. Comments?
I couldn't help but notice that we got to the place of forgiveness and didn't spend a lot of time there. And again, going back to my Christian religion, is that was the whole focus, was forgiveness. Yeah. But then it didn't go anywhere else. You know, I mean, we were forgiven. You know, so it's, I guess, what I'm feeling now is that it's that transformation. It's not just enough to be forgiven. It's like we have to transform and become the individual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's forgiven isn't enough.
Yeah. Well, then I think in you know, in the Christian tradition, it's then you're God's child, or you serve in Christ's name, and you go out and serve, you know, fulfilling that activity or whatever, you know. What do they call it? The, like, apostles, you know, there's like...
Yeah, I thought maybe you could address that a little more, because you're so good at all the different... The thread that goes between all the religions.
Well, I think one thing that we have to recognize is that forgiveness is kind of like what Lama Poldon was saying about the two blessings. You know, it's like, oh yeah, okay, so you... I'm sorry, what was the name again?
The two offerings.
Two offerings, yeah. It's like two offerings, okay, well yes, just do the two offerings, but you go into it, you find there's a whole practice in there which you can spend ages playing with and seeing different facets and possibilities. Well, forgiveness is an extraordinarily profound practice, which I avoided for a while. It just seemed too simple, and then I tried it and once again discovered, you know, simple does not mean easy. And so forgiveness is a whole practice unto itself, both the giving and the receiving of it. And to learn how to forgive is just very profound. Forgiveness is the letting go of aversion. And aversion runs extremely deep. You know, as long as there's dualism and delusion, there's aversion. So Buddhism focuses probably more, addiction and aversion are twin-born, that is, they arise together as mirror images. And one can work on either to reduce both And different traditions emphasize, both Christianity emphasizes more the working with aversion than the through forgiveness. In fact, one could say forgiveness is the primary or a primary practice of Christianity. It's a tradition which above all others, emphasizes forgiveness. Buddhism emphasizes more the working with the craving, although it certainly has lots of forgiveness practices, but it's more emphasizes the reduction of craving. But I think it's very important to realize that forgiveness, both the giving and the receiving, are practices, and they're probably lifelong, and they go very, very deep. And to really forgive means letting go of aversion. So that's a whole practice unto itself, which one can work in various ways. To really experience oneself as forgiven is to, I hadn't thought of this till now, but at its depths, to realize one's true nature. The deepest level of being forgiven is recognizing there's nothing to forgive in the first place. Firstly, the acts were empty, and secondly, there's no one to forgive or be forgiven. And if, to the extent one thinks there is, then they and we are acting in delusion. So this gets very, very deep. Were there other facets you were thinking of? I think just to emphasize, it's a bottomless practice as far as I can see.
And maybe, why Vajrasattva is such a core practice for all the Vajrayana traditions is we can't step into our Buddha nature until we forgive ourselves. It's impossible. And the more we're able to do that, the more we're able to step into the Buddha nature, open into that. People have comments.
Please.
You beautifully laid this out. It's quite moving to me to hear this story very openly. And I'm also aware that it's very thorough to a certain lens.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience with Vajrasattva, like with my personal makeup, is sometimes surprisingly emotional.
Yeah.
And I find myself sobbing, the forgiveness thing, all of a sudden I'm forgiving myself for all the ants I've killed, and it's not logical, it's not, linear, it's just all of a sudden I'm just bursting with tears, sobbing, all in the impact. And
absolutely, me too. And I've given, partly because it's I'm a heady type, I've given it in an intellectual, conceptual framework, and partly because that's the way we communicate, is through concepts. So, but you're making me realize it would have been good had I emphasized more the emotional aspect, and that was one of the big surprises for me, that the intensity of emotions around this, both the releasing of emotions and the cultivating of positive emotions. There's one little facet, just a couple of lines in my version of it, which says, after the purification, you receive the nectar again, and then you receive the four empowerments and the four thises and the four joys and the four immeasurables. Well, those are just a couple of lines, but you sit and experience the four joys, the four centers lighting up and becoming ecstatic and blissful and so forth. Well, there's a ride itself, and then you practice the four boundless qualities, and you fill with boundless love and compassion, equanimity and empathic joy. Whoa, that's only a couple of lines, The amount in this practice is extraordinary, just extraordinary. And yes, thank you. I appreciate it. Now you're making me realize I really should have given more time and or attention to the emotional side, because it just blew me away. Wasn't expecting it in this practice. You know, I expected in doing the immeasurables or the mandala offering or something, but I wasn't expecting it as much in this. And yeah, it's wonderful. Oh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say a little bit more about refuge. I'm going back to refuge, and I'm noticing it's really powerful because I started doing, you know, refuge, and then I was doing Vajrasattva, and I was mixing it, and now I'm going back, kind of complete at least the first part of Vajrasattva I'm going to do, and I'm noticing, like, the emotion that's there for the refuge. It's really different than the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time it was more like a humble and opening, and now it's just like my whole heart chakra is just opening, and yet even within that, you know, I feel that big opening, and I still can feel the ego though, a little part that's kind of like it wavers between feeling completely connected in a way, and in another way it's like not worthy, or you know, it's very subtle, but I can just feel that in there.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about, you know,
get used to it.
You know, digging down deeper and finding those, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I found the best way of having some, bringing some negativity back is to think I'm finally complete with it. So, yeah. Well, first off, it sounds wonderful. Second, it's a beautiful example of the fact that any practice we do tends to enrich other practices. You know, it's really nice to see how that works. Third, is you're pointing to the fact that each practice goes through cycles, and yet it seems there's an organic process at work, that we open and deepen, and the opening is what and deepening is what allows the next layer of stuff to come up, and the trap is of thinking, you know, being attached to where we were, attached to the depths and so forth, which is a great way of staying shallow. And you know, and so it seems, as far as I can see, an optimal attitude is one of welcoming whatever arises. I think of the centering prayer, where one of the words they just work with, the simple practice of just using one word is welcome. And whatever experience arises, welcome. I find that's a very nice attitude to bring to this and any practice. You know, you never know what's going to come up. You sit down, it's like, well, I wonder where this will go this time. And yes, there is egoic stuff that, you know, and then, you know, there are moments where the boundaries dissolve and we're being bowed and the practice is being done through us, and then we come back and, you know, and the ride continues. Is there anything more you want to say about that?
Really, I appreciating what you're saying about experimenting, and a couple of us were talking during the break just about how powerful the reframing is, and all these practices contain that, like reframing the state, or, you know, being with a Buddha field, you know, seeing the whole world as a Lama. It's like the whole thing is being reframed continuously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, bringing that, you know, kind of, it's a grand experiment, but curiosity is what really helps, and I appreciate your encouraging us on that part.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to emphasize something that I think Lama Paul and I were both saying, it really has been a repetitive surprise to me, realize to how much the practice is an experiment. You know, first, because it's unique for each of us, and second, because the instructions are summary capsules, and you know, a couple, as we were talking about, a couple of lines can open out into all sorts of ways. And then there's the fact that the process has a life of its own. And we kind of go along for the ride and explore it and milk it as best we can. Yeah.
Somebody's still formulating my thoughts about this, but as I did refuge and Vajrasattva practice, you know, at some point I was noticing that, you know, my life is shifting, my relationships are more positive, you know, you see things getting working better in life, and from the lens of psychology, starting to ask why that might be, right? And I, for me at least, I came to the conclusion that refuge practice seemed to repair damaged object relations that psychotherapy never, ever could reach for whatever reason. And the Vajrasanga had a lot to do with shame, bringing out shame, you know, self-hate, things like that. And then in thinking about that, we were sort of having a conversation here at the break about where does psychology, how far does psychology take you, and where does spirituality maybe take over, or I don't think it's really that clean, they're sort of mixed together, but and I was like, you see, you think, well, so okay, I repair these object relations, well, now I gotta let go of them, right? It seems to be different. So I guess I'm sort of curious about your comments about that in general, and also about psychology versus spirituality and healing and growth, you know, where they overlap or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that's an exploration and an interface we are just beginning to investigate. And I think the question, which is probably most pragmatically important, is what's the optimal use of both, and what's the optimal way in which they can facilitate each other. I suspect that's a good century's work ahead of us. You know, for example, we're still not really clear on, one of the questions is, you know, what facets of being does each of these practices transform, and what does it leave untouched? Clearly, there are some ways in which you can, you know, you can, it's clear one can do, some people can do spiritual practices and have some very deep insights and have, you know, be totally untouched in other parts of their being. Now, one extraordinarily beneficial aspect of this tradition is it seems to have, as far as I can see, the richest array of practices of any tradition I've run across. And they seem to be largely complementary, so it seems to be designed as a kind of, you know, a safety net, because you know, different practices seem to complement one another. But the question of what works best, what spiritual practices are best for, and what psychotherapy is best for, we are not yet clear. If I had to take an initial hypothetical stab, I would say that they can be complementary, particularly in good hands. That psychotherapy is probably best, may be particularly effective for working with significant pathology. Psychotherapy is essentially aimed at pathology reduction. These practices are aimed primarily at health improvement, spiritual awakening, although they clearly facilitate the reduction of pain and pathology. I would guess that therapy could be more effective with things like work in the world, initially anyway. I'm not saying this doesn't do it, but I think this is a question that's open for exploration, and we have a lot of work ahead of us. But for myself, I have to say I found the combination of both to be very valuable. I found it valuable to, you know, I started off in therapy. That was what got me into this whole inner world and inner game. And then I discovered spiritual practices, and they took me much further and deeper than psychotherapy could. And I found it valuable to go back into therapy at times to work with things that come up in practice. For example, I've been going back recently and doing EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, because I find it's very powerful for dealing with some deep ingrained patterns that I keep running, bumping up against in these practices. And it seems to be, you know, for certain discrete issues, it seems to be really great for moving through those fast in a way that I haven't been able to do with the meditation. But it's an exploration. You know, this is the first generation in history that's had both disciplines available to us. So it's a whole new ball game.
Very exciting,
But I don't think we're going to get let go of our object relations till probably, they, I think, around eighth level bodhisattva, yeah. Maybe. Eighth or ninth level. It means, it's a term in psychology, it means the relation between self and other. Basically, all our karma is, you know, the baby, first you don't understand you're separate from your mom, and then you develop, you know, me and other, and the relations between those two. So, you know, the way psychology looks at it is a little limited. The way I work with it, with people, is it's kind of bigger in terms that, to me, our object relations that get constellated in this life between our primary caregiver and the infant are simply a reflection of our karmic object relations that are playing out in this life, or at least what we chose to work out or what came up to work out in this life in particular. So, you know, and it really has a lot to do with this whole thing. Because in some ways, it's our object relations that are the smudge on the crystal that keep us from being able to see everything as the purity that it really is, as a Buddha field, as a pure realm, and ourselves as awakened beings. You know, it kind of interplays.
Crystallistic thinking.
But it's a psychological term, meaning, you know... exactly how that's constituted psychologically for each individual and how healthy or unhealthy that is. Can you say more, Roger, from a psychiatric?
No. Yeah. Not, I'd say relation. The essence is relationship. I think it's a lousy term, object relations, but still, it's what it is. It's the idea that we constellate representations in the psyche of self and others, and then that's what we relate to.
It's, we think that's reality.
Yeah.
And how we form, because we form those at such a young age, and so we stick to those concepts of how we relate.
Yeah. Well, we're relating, as always, we're relating with our own mind.
Funny how, like, you know, like. Some of my male Dharma brothers were saying that funny how Kala Rinpoche, for all of them, was sort of like they noticed it was a repeat of their father experience. In other words, they projected their father issues onto the guru. Well, you know, that's just an example. You know, we project our mother-father issues onto our spouse or our guru.
But it would be limiting to say that Bodhisattva is a kind of reparenting because it does something different to our psyche.
Well, I would say it's a hell of a lot else too. I mean, it does so many things. So many things.
Yeah, because there's a whole level where I think, like we were saying, you know, it's hard to even verbalize or know or understand all the levels these practices are working on. But I think there's, I don't know if I can put this into words, but like, in the whole psychophysical system, it's like a transformational process that gets set in motion. And the more attention and all these, you know, that we bring to it, then the more powerful that is. And it's like, you know, sending, you know, a wagon downhill. So that transformational process is then in movement, in motion, and has its own momentum, you know, and... then, you know, I think eventually it's sort of like with spiritual practice, it's like climbing a mountain, and finally the momentum is you're actually, you know, it just, the momentum is starts to carry you. Of course, it's still, awareness is still what's needed. But I wanted to just bring up one important point that Roger brought up. How important and powerful this is with the recent brain studies, that imagining yourself doing something or being something and that actually happening, in other words, say for example with sports, you know, they found out with imagery, if you imagine you're still doing the sport after you're injured, you don't have muscle loss, which you would have if you didn't imagine yourself. So you can be imagining, if you're, you know, a swimmer, that you're still swimming while you can't swim. it does this, you know, your muscles will stay toned. So imagining in the brain, you know, it's still getting the message. And so imagining ourselves as Vajrasattva or Tara, whoever, you know, it is creating that reality in the brain circuitry.
That reminds me of something when I did Theravada and Sylvia Bornstein said. She said, you know, meta practice, when I was doing meta intensively, she said it's a mechanical term, but she said it's like rewiring your whole brain, and, you know, and it's true. It's kind of hard to name what it is, but there's a whole redo.
We were talking the other day about how, you know, we called it rewiring. We thought that was metaphorical, but it's actually turning out to be very literal.
Yeah.
Willow, you had some comment?
I was curious about, just from your experience, specifically the Aliza visualization. If you could say, it was very powerful for me to hear you talk about your experience about the lineage tree, basically, and how, and then the same way it was for the people who talked about incorporating different traditions and just allowing for that natural creativity centering through Lashon Hara. I'm wondering from the Aliza part of Lashon Hara practice, if there's anything that stands out for you in your direct experience from that, specifically that part of the practice.
I don't recall any specific way in which that imagery matured. I do know that one of the things that there was a big surprise that came, and that was that, particularly when I was in retreat, I noticed the reduction in intensity of guilt or pain around various foolishnesses in my past. But what really surprised me was that at a certain stage I recalled some stupidities I'd done that I hadn't recalled previously and hadn't worked with, and noticed that their intensity had gone down too, that there was a kind of generalization effect. So even though I was working with some specific issues, there seemed to be a more general deconditioning or rewiring or whatever metaphor of all related issues. So that was very nice to find out.
Yeah, and they say, I remember Kola Rinpoche saying, obviously we're not going to remember everything that's been going on since we've been in samsara, so, and since we've been deluded. So it is general, it does work to all of it, you know. And I mean also simply confessing all that we don't know. But
yeah, there's something about the general attitude as well as the specific content, which is
right.
Healing.
Yeah.